Hey, everybody, it's Paul Yeager, and this is the MTOM Show podcast, a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. In our quest, in our mission to be as, let's say, global, knowledge-based, filled with information about what goes on around the world, you should talk to those from around the world. We're going to do that today. We're going to head to Russia. We're going to talk with Andrei Sisov. Andrei Sisov, let me get his name right, is our guest, and he follows commodities in the Black Sea region very closely. We're going to talk about wheat. We're going to talk about corn. We're going to talk about the relationship between his region and China, the United States, Canada, Australia, Brazil, in this global world marketplace. And if you're going to talk with somebody from Russia, you got to talk about the great grain robbery, right? We'll find out how that was viewed in country, how it was viewed shortly after and today. And are we seeing it again happening in front of our very eyes? We'll get Andre's take. We're also going to talk about trading partners. We're going to look at things a little bit differently, but he's followed the United States closely, been to the U.S. several times, knows this country. Who do they follow? Who do they look at? Do they see the weather in North Dakota, South Dakota, in the Corn Belt, just like we watch what goes on in Ukraine and Russia? That's today's discussion on the MTOM Show podcast. Do you see your home country as a big mystery to Americans? I mean, we always talk about Russia. I'm of the age when the Rocky movie was the big behind-the-curtain look at Russia. Was that an accurate depiction of the world in the 80s? Let's talk global politics first, Andre.
Okay. as I recall, it wasn't the first Rocky about Soviet Union. The first Rocky action was the best one. It wasn't about Soviet Union wasn't involved at that time. I think it was probably Rocky 3 or something like that.
It was Rocky 4, I think.
Rocky 4. Okay, yeah. That was relatively close. Yeah. Probably, yes, there was still a lot of the Iron Curtain, fortunately, has fallen. The country became way more open. Now it's getting a bit more closed again, but way more open compared to 80s. And I think, I'm not sure if it's a mystery, but I think I would agree to a statement that it's still a big... There are a lot of misconceptions about what's going on here in Russia. And another misconception that Russia is Ukraine is more or less the same. You know, they're close, it's former Soviet Union. And for many people, Kyiv, Moscow, more or less the same country. No, it's not like that. And it's not like that, especially when we talk about agriculture now and things.
Right. And the reason I start with misconceptions is I do want to get into that in just a moment in agriculture. But you are in Moscow today, but that's your home area. Tell me about Moscow.
I'm in Moscow today. It's a nice, big city, which got better in recent years, I think substantially, way more cleaner, way more greener. And we see here in Moscow that many of oil dollars that Russia has been making in recent decades were spent here relatively wisely. But, you know, unfortunately, Moscow, it's not the whole country. And I think for Russia, that's my just personal guess. I think for Russia, the difference between Moscow and non-Moscow area is way bigger compared to the U.S., for example.
Well, you make it sound like city versus rural versus urban, just like we have here in the United States. So it sounds like that's not just an isolated America thing. Things are different in the city versus to the country.
Yeah, but my point is the difference is way bigger here in Moscow in terms of way of living, standards of living in Russia compared to more developed countries where things are different is smaller.
Yeah. So you're from that area. On a farm in the city, what was your? I think it wasn't necessarily where you grew up, but tell me a little bit about your background.
So I have a financial education, Then I also got an MBA from one of top international business schools. But how I got into agriculture, there are probably two important stages. When I was a kid, we had a small country house, and we still have it. It's near Moscow, and I was there walking at the garden near the country house, some apple trees, some cucumbers. It wasn't hot enough, warm enough for tomatoes, as I recall, and still not. And I was there and actually spent a lot of time there in the garden. And I didn't like that, I have to admit. And fast forward 10 years or 15 years, my father, Andrei Sizov Sr., he set up our firm, Sovicon, which, and I mentioned director of Sovicon now. And I joined him after some time after the firm was launched. And the firm was, from the very beginning, it was focused on research of agricultural markets. And we're still doing that, covering our main focus is Black Sea. And by Black Sea, I mean Russia and Ukraine, to a lesser extent, Kazakhstan.
Is that all that you think is considered the Black Sea region, like those three? I mean, does Turkey, does Romania? I mean, they all touch the Black Sea, but
yeah.
Tell me how that region is named.
Yeah, geographically, obviously, you are right. It's we should add Romania, but from analyst perspective, Romania is part of the EU. That's another story. Turkey is just a big importer. It's very big and important importer of wheat and other agricultural crops, but it's we're not really covering it. It's not producer. So basically, we're focused on former Soviet Union countries which have access to the Black Sea. Kazakhstan, obviously, it's a landlocked country, doesn't have direct access, but it's important to be that part of the puzzle in mind, because there are still a big producer of wheat, first of all, and somehow need to sell it via Black Sea, via Caspian Sea, which is not geographically sea, and also via rail to China.
How would you describe the agriculture landscape of the region?
So I think it's still being transformed quite rapidly, and everything began around 30 years ago when the Soviet Union collapsed. Let me remind you that in the 80s, Soviet Union obviously wasn't the most popular place in the world. But I think many farmers did like Soviet Union because it was the largest importer of grains in the world. Wheat, first of all, wheat, also some corn, more than 30 million tons. I think it was close to 40 million tons imports at that time. The Soviet agriculture, as other parts of Soviet economy, were very far from being efficient. Then everything collapsed in late 80s, early 90s. And starting from late 90s, the sector began to recover, not to recover, but began to grow relatively fast, and it's still growing. So the major factor is just transformation from that inefficient Soviet economy, Soviet agriculture, planned economy, to just market-driven economy. Farmers receive the freedom to plant what they want, to sell it how they want, and they also got access to huge 7 billion world market, and as a result, high prices in many years, which drove the production higher, and it's still trending higher. First of all, in Ukraine, in Russia, things began to stagnate slightly in recent years because the government just started to mess with agriculture more again, and definitely not not a good sign for agriculture development.
You said 30 years ago, so I'm thinking about what happened in the 30 years prior to the 80s, post-World War II, feeding itself. Was that region feeding itself? You mentioned a huge amount of imports. What was the struggle in trying to feed itself post-World War II to the end of the Iron Curtain?
The short answer is it was very inefficient. I mean, so people were just telling, bureaucrats were telling farmers what to plant and where, in many cases, that those regions were not suited well for production of those crops. Efficiency was very low. Just to give you an example, so I'm just saying efficiency was very low, but it just was. Just to give an example, Russia now and in recent years has been the largest wheat exporter in the world, doing more than 30 million tons, and the record was record high number was 41 million tons of wheat exported. And we are producing, if we talk about total grains, Russia is producing 120, 130 million tons, just 10, 20 million tons above the Soviet level. But we're exporting 30, 40, 50 million tons of total grain. So we're roughly producing more or less the same volume which we produced 30, 40 years ago, but exporting 30, 40, 50 million tons. So, and what has changed about that increase which happened in recent 20 years? What has changed? The domestic consumption has changed substantially. Feed conversion ratios, they just improved several times. And this is just an example when I'm talking about low efficiency. So basically, with the higher meat production, we are consuming less, way less grain for feed compared to Soviet times. And as a result, we can export compared to the fact that we were large importers in the past. And so if you look at the country, Russia, Ukraine is a smaller country. It's easy to describe Ukraine. But look in Russia, for example, what we've seen in during those 20 years, recent 20 years, what we've seen, we're planting more, in fact, in south of Russia, in central Russia compared to Soviet times. But the area in more eastern regions like Urals, like Siberia, like Volga Valley has decreased substantially. For simple reason, there is no economical reason to grow grains there. So, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So, but the initial question why the country was failing to feed itself, because it wasn't efficient, because it was not, despite huge area, planting area, it was not growing grain efficiently and other crops. The livestock sector was pretty inefficient and was consuming a lot of grain and oil seeds. Feed conversion ratios were awful. Also, I think a few important mistakes were made when the Russian Soviet authorities were thinking about the future of the livestock sector. They decided to develop so-called meat and dairy livestock, which is not efficient as meat and dairy. They decided to mix everything together, and it didn't work well. And as a result of efficiency in the livestock sector, in production, the country couldn't feed itself.
So efficiency has been a word that American farmers have talked about becoming better efficient at, utilizing the land that is shrinking and that we can produce crops. And so was there a reason the efficiency changed? Was there outside global influence to say, hey, let's help you get better? Or was it an inner workings of a country and a region that said, we've got to do better?
So I think so. After that collapse, just the government set more or less reasonable rules, liberalization of foreign trade, a long-term rent and ownership of land in terms of Russia. By the way, Ukraine just a week ago, they liberalized their land market for the first time. Now you can buy and sell land in Ukraine. But so you had as a farmer, you knew that you own that land, you own those crops, and you will, or at least you have a long-term lease, and there's incentive to produce better, contrary to collective farm, because collective farm, you don't know what actually those crops belong to, but when it's yours, it's yours. So they had an intensive to increase the efficiency because of that. And we changed our crop rotation substantially in Russia and Ukraine, to less extent in Kazakhstan. For example, Ukraine started to grow way more corn compared to Soviet times. Russia began to grow way more wheat compared to Soviet times. So it was one part of this equation. And as was, external influence, if you mean external influence, the access to the world market, yes, it was a very important factor when farmers began to sell their grains, not to necessarily to a mill or some kind of state enterprise, or they began to sell to international traders buying at FOB Black Sea. And yes, that was a huge help. They began to receive higher prices. And also, I would say, other factors would be a previous cycle of higher global agricultural prices, which we saw 2007, 2008. Yes, that's relatively recently, but I think that helped a lot. 2009, and prices began to collapse after 2012, I think. But before that, we had high prices, and that also helped a lot the region to develop. And probably another factor would be number four is global warming. It was very beneficial for the region, both Russia and Ukraine. We are not southern enough to feel big problems, at least for now, because of high temperatures. And fortunately, it's not hotter summers. It's mainly milder winters in the region. And that's why we have way less winter kill. That's why in Russia, winter wheat array is going up, up, and up, and spring wheat array is declining slowly. And that's very important factor for wheat production. And also for this, first of all, important for Ukraine and to less extent for Russia, because of warmer temperatures during spring and summer, we now have enough temperatures to develop to grow our corn on big area, and that was a very important factor for Ukraine and Russia. I should add here that officially it's not allowed to grow any GM crops in Russia and Ukraine. So basically it's mainly it's hybrids. Some farmers unofficially do grow those crops, especially in Ukraine. But it's mainly hybrid. So GM trends that helped farmers a lot in the US and Latin America, it wasn't a big factor here. Obviously, we see some newer and more productive varieties, but it's not such, and biotech crops are not allowed here, so it's not such an important factor compared to other regions. But global warming is.
Global warming is. So GMOs is still a swear word over there. And yeah. Do you see that changing anytime soon?
I think, but so in reality, Ukraine does grow substantial volume of GM soybeans, first of all. In Russia, I think it's very limited area if exists, because in Russia, it's more, the government is way stronger and they control everything more strictly. In Ukraine, it's more relaxed. Officially, I doubt that GM will be approved here for various reasons. One of them, I think, Russia and Ukraine, they steal, and Ukraine, first of all, look at what the EU does, and European Union is still very conservative when we talk about GM crops. But I think sooner or later it will be here, but probably it won't be GM. It will be CRISPR crops. So, you know, it's not transgenic crops when you put one, take one gene from or one crop or animal and put in another. So it's not transgenic, but it's CRISPR when you just edit DNA within one crop, for example, but don't insert any genes outside. I think it will be, sooner or later, it will be approved in the EU, and sooner or later, Russia and Ukraine will be forced to approve those new biotech crops if they don't want to lose in this pace. And another reason, just, you know, I said that so far global warming was, I think, beneficial for the region, but I think sooner or later it could change, and it's not like ages, it could be, you know, 5-10 years perhaps, we will see way more droughts, and we will need drought-resistant varieties, but with traditional breeding, it will take decades to develop those varieties, but with biotech crops, everything takes, I know, probably a few years, yeah, including registration. Everything goes way, way faster, so the region will have to adopt them, I think.
How did the Russia-Ukraine relationship with China for trade develop? When did that, and is it at peak right now, that relationship of trade?
So I think for both countries, it's a very important partner. Support from politicians in both countries is quite high. If you talk about agriculture, for definitely it's a very important buyer for Ukrainian crops. First of all, corn. Actually, before the current season, 2021, Ukraine was the largest supplier of corn before the U.S. took the number one place this season. And Ukraine will definitely remain a very large supplier of corn to China, plus some other things like sunflower. Sunflower actually is number two cash crop here, I think it's small crop for North America, but it's a very important crop for farms here. So Ukraine sells a lot of corn. That's number one item. Also some sunflower, sun oil, some other oil seeds. And indeed, it's China for Ukraine is a very important market. For Russia, there are also a lot of talks. There are cooperation when we talk about energy, for example, gas. But when we talk about agriculture, in reality, the volume is quite limited. As I say, for example, for Russia, China is the number one market for beans. Russia does export some soybeans to China. So, but for China, Russian imports are less than 1% of the total imports. So, actual volumes are very low. When we talk about Russia, some beans, 1 million tons, something like that, some wheat, some oilseed, but relatively it's a very small scale, despite Russian authorities and Russia probably does want to sell more to China. And potentially medium term, 5 years, 7 years, if we see development of the Russian Far East, that's Russia is a huge country, that's very eastern part of the country, which is near China and which is near northern eastern China, Heilongjiang province. That's a major producer of corn, for example, just to give you a perspective. And Russian Far East is just to the north from that region. So potentially Russian Far East could be a huge producer of corn and soybeans medium term, but definitely we need more investments to boost the production there. And so far, despite that region has been already integrated more or less in trading with China, it's selling more than 50%, I think, of all beans grown there. So far, the progress has been limited because it needs to grow production substantially. But I would keep an eye on this if you are a U.S. farmer or Brazilian farmer, because potentially longer term, and a good precipitation, lots of land, good climate for beans and corn, so basically could be two crops rotation, and potentially indeed it can grow its production substantially, but it definitely needs more time.
How do you in Russia, where you're sitting again, I just go back to that. How do you view the back and forth between the American, the United States, and China when it comes to agriculture exports? I mean, the previous administration was taking a different line than had been taken. How do you see that conflict between the two? Do you see it as conflict? Let me ask it that way first. Do you see it as there's conflict?
Yeah, obviously, personally, I do see that conflict. And, you know, it's not only U.S., China, Australia, China, Canada. But yeah, the biggest one is obviously the U.S., China. If we talk about Russia, I don't know, official media, it was some optimism, definitely, like, you know, they're going to fight, and that's a huge opportunity for Russian agriculture, and we're going to sell a lot because they, those trade wars. In reality, again, the volume which Russia is selling to China are very, very modest, even for Russia, and I'm not talking about the huge Chinese imports. Even for Russia, they're very modest. They're big, if we talk of soybeans, but it's small crop, small export crop for Russia. There is a hope to sell more, but in reality, and I think China is not really interested in Russian grain. So Russia is a huge exporter of grain. China, what I feel, is not really interested. For example, they haven't approved, you know, you need approval from the authorities, from phytosanitary approval from the authorities that Russia or any other region can sell their crops or livestock to the country. So, for example, just a very limited number of regions in Russia have been approved by Chinese authorities and have a right to sell their crops to China. So oil seeds, they are more relaxed about oil seeds. They want to see more oil seeds from Russia. But but it's relatively, for Russia, it's not such a big crop, oil seeds. So
Russia's not growing oil seeds yet, but are they going to?
Russia is growing oil seeds, but not enough. Just total oil seeds production around 20 million tons total. And we used to export around 2 million. So, and compare that to 100 million of soybeans imported by China. So it's very small volume.
We always think of competition makes us stronger.
Yeah.
But I think you're going to probably tell me something about if we're better at what we do, we always produce more. Therefore, we've got to find more outlets for our product. But if we don't produce more, we always have that balance of there's not enough food. The Russians remember hunger more than the Americans do or some of the other countries. So that's got to be on the mind of a Ukrainian producer. Is that an accurate statement, that they've got to make sure they keep producing? Because in America, the farmer always says, we're feeding the world. Does the Ukrainian and the Russian farmer think they are feeding the world, or are they feeding more just their own people?
I think in reality, Ukrainian and Russian farmers are just a bit probably too. I doubt that they think that way. You know, they don't have that luxury, let me put it that way, to think that way. I think they need to just, you know, they need to deal with many issues they have currently, especially in Russia, with very strict export taxes. So no, I don't think that way.
All right. You're a few hours ahead of us before the, while we're talking, the Chicago Board of Trade has just opened. Do you work later in the day to follow what goes on the board? Or are you looking more at the overnight trade, or how does it rate for you?
Sometimes our days are relatively long because we obviously want to see what's happening in Chicago in main session. Overnight, it's a very convenient session for us, but it's very small volumes and typically not many things are happening overnight.
What's a typical day for you?
Typical day. I start my day, check emails, check our chat, internal chat in our firm. Then I get to do some calls to clients if I have any inquiries. Then send a few emails, trying to sell a few subscriptions.
Because primarily that's your business is subscriptions and your information and expertise.
Yeah, we're not brokers, we're not traders, we don't do that. So we don't have to follow Chicago on hourly or on hourly basis. Yeah, so we sell subscriptions, we sell information, we sell data. Our proposition is we help to people not to get caught with any problems coming out of the Black Sea, whether it's drought, whether it's some kind of ban, so it's an important export hub, pretty fast growing export hub, I think could be compared to Brazil nowadays only, but it's very opaque because of different mentality, because of language issues, and we help people to be sure that they won't, they are short and they see a ban, a Russian wheat ban, for example, tomorrow, and lose a lot of money. So this is what we do.
Do you? We talk about sometime on our show about the Russian wheat crop or the Ukraine or it rained or it's dry. Do you look at weather models of the United States as much as some people look at your region's weather patterns?
Sure. It's a global market. And so it was a question about farmers previously. And I think it has all changed a lot then. Farmers became way more market-driven, market-oriented. So they do follow, for example, not Chicago prices, but they do follow Egyptian tenders. That's the largest buyer. Egypt is the largest wheat buyer in the world. And their tenders are very important benchmark for Russian and Ukrainian wheat market and global wheat market, and they do follow that. And as it's a global market, yes, we do look. Our main focus is Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, but we do look at regions which have problems. It was Brazil, and it's still Brazil, but it's kind of off the radar. And currently, obviously, yes, it's Northern Dakota, spring wheat area in U.S. and Canadian prairies. That's a lot of problems. Over there, and we do follow that as well as obviously China, because Chinese imports were the largest story, in my view, during the current season.
What's the biggest story for the rest of 2021 from where you sit?
Globally, I would say Chinese inputs, definitely, because it was if you remember the beginning of the current season, which is now close to the end for corn, you remember those 6-7 million tons of inputs for China, and then just all estimates skyrocketed to 20, 25, 26 million tons. Private estimates were up to 30 million tons. And so that's the number one question, what Chinese inputs will be in 2021-22. Because, for example, it's a it's even way more packed compared to the Black Sea. But we see that, for example, FAS, Foreign Attaché Service, US FAS in Beijing, they lowered their estimate of input substantially below USDA's, and I think that's a very important factor. And on top of that, we had that story with ASF. It's obviously on radar. And it looks like they indeed have rebuilt their herd, but when talking about China, you can't be sure 100% in anything. So I think that's a very important story. Another one, but we follow all of us are following very closely. It's obviously corn outlook for the US, because in my view, and in the current season, it also was the case, it's the biggest driver for wheat market. It was the biggest driver in the previous season. It's going to be the biggest driver in the new season as well. And probably we'll also be looking at, we also have to look at our region closely. Probably we'll have a good record high crop of wheat in Ukraine. It's more or less now it's just there is very low risk of low possibility of any problems with the new wheat crop in Ukraine. As per Russia, and I think it's not fully reflected in prices. As per Russia, I think the market on the contrary could be a bit too optimistic about Russian crop. USDA has very high number for Russia at the moment, in my view. And we see that some regions in Russia, we started to harvest a new crop just a week ago. Some regions in Russia, they do have very good starting yields, record high starting yields, but it's not the case for the whole country. And again, it's a very huge country. South of Russia, one story. Volga Valley is another story. Central Russia, it's another story. And we feel that the market could be overestimating Russian crop at the moment. So it's one part. Wheat. And also Russia is a huge producer of spring wheat, and there were a lot of problems with spring wheat earlier this season. And another topic, if we talk about the Black Sea, it's a corn crop. Russia is a relatively small producer, 15 million tons, something like that, probably, this year. But Ukraine is a very big producer and very important producer, I think, for U.S. farmers, because it's their biggest competitor in the Chinese markets. And as I said, China inputs is a very important story for the corn market for the next season as well. Currently, we see a record high area, almost record high area under corn in Ukraine, 5.4 million hectares. Good setup, not ideal for wheat. For winter wheat in the region, it's almost ideal setup. But for corn, it's a good setup, not ideal. And if with some weather cooperation, even limited one, Ukraine very likely to harvest a record high corn crop. And probably, I think, the market underestimates Ukrainian crop. We have some U.S. clients, and we talk a lot of the U.S. Potential clients, and we feel that for many of them, Ukraine is completely off the radar. They look at U.S., of course, then they look at Brazil, Argentina, and they completely miss Ukraine in many cases, while in reality, Ukrainian corn exports this season could be close to Argentinian corn exports, more than 30 million tons. Lower exports to the EU because of better crops and better crop in the EU, and more exports in China. So, for example, I think this season they could sell around 9-10 million tons of corn to China. And in the next season, probably the volume could be the same or even higher. Potentially, next season, it could be 50-50 Ukraine and U.S., especially if Chinese imports will indeed will be lower compared to the current season. So I think Ukraine is a very, and particularly Ukrainian corn crop is also a very important story if you talk about the Black Sea.
When you look to the next couple of years, maybe even 5 to 10 years down the road, the relationship that Ukraine and Russia has with China is important. Is it also important for Russia and Ukraine and Black Sea farmers to have a strong trading partner with someone else as well to offer another outlet, just as a hedge, as a covering my base unless something strange goes on and China says, we're not taking grain from anybody. We're going to do it all ourselves now. Is that in the mindset right now of leaders in your area?
So for Ukraine, China is indeed a very big and important buyer, but it's not the only buyer. Ukraine sells a lot of corn to the EU, to Egypt and other destinations. Ukraine sells a lot of wheat, 20 million tons, 25 million tons, to many other destinations. So China is not like the story, for example, when for Australian barley, China was the largest market by far. It's not the case for Russia and Ukraine. It's not the case for Ukraine, and for Russia, it's very far from. China is a relatively small buyer of crops from Russia. It's a more important buyer for Ukrainian crops, but it's not like the only buyer. So,
yeah.
So both markets, both countries, Russia and Ukraine, they do want to expand their presence all over the world. It's back to your question about the competition. For example, Russia and Ukraine, Black Sea, started to sell its wheat to Saudi Arabia during the previous season. It's not a top buyer, but 5, 6, perhaps 7 million tons a year. That's quite a big buyer. And that's a new market for Black Sea wheat. We do look closely at the Algerian market. It's one of top wheat buyers. They eased their specification for wheat in the previous season, but at the same time, they upped some other specifications. So far, supplies were very limited. There was just one report that one vessel from Russia sailed to Algeria. But it's hopefully we'll see more Black Sea wheat in Algeria. But I don't think that's a very important topic for U.S. wheat farmers. It's a very important topic for French with farmers, because Algeria is a top buyer.
Andre, on our show, we always discuss, or at least we have for the last few months, the great grain robbery involving Russia in the 1970s. Sue Martin likes to talk about it. Tell me your perspective about it. What was it?
Sure. So I used to work when I was 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, I actually used to work for a firm called Export Hleb, and that firm, they did those negotiations during the great grain robbery. In Soviet Union, it was considered a big success. We kind of tricked those Americans and bought lots of grain at relatively low price. But I think despite that, it was kind of short-term success, because Soviet Union remained for a decade afterwards, remained a large importer of grain and didn't improve its production before everything started, as we said, 30, 40 years ago. And as per U.S., I think U.S. did, there were some good conclusions and takeaways were very reasonable. It improved substantially its reporting system, and that benefited the country a lot. And it also actually benefited the whole world, because the whole global grain market became way more transparent and efficient as a result, implying at the end of the day that buyers, for example, are paying less and risks are low in the market.
Are we having another one of those right now with China?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, that's a kind of popular topic to discuss. They are great corn robberies happening today or something like that. I don't think it's happening. First, I think the market more or less understand what's really going on with inputs because of that reporting system. It's not ideal, and we can see cancellations, and there were some problems that, you know, there was a Chinese entity, it's formerly American, and bought that grain, and it reported it later and been reflected in reports later. But overall, I think the market, it's more or less understanding what's going on because of USDA's reporting system, because of other sources, for example, private banks, Goldman Sachs, I think they were talking about that ahead of the market, that China will increase inputs. So it's not a shock compared to what we had decades ago because of more transparency, because of information, because of other source of data like lineups, vessel data. The global market became way, way more transparent compared to what it was half a decade ago. And so it's now it's very hard to do a robbery again.
All right, I'll finish with this. If I'm an American producer sitting in the Corn Belt right now, what should I be watching in Ukraine and Russia? What should I be watching on a regular basis to see what you're doing, what you're growing, how it's going, just so I know what my competition's doing?
If we talk about current season, I think Ukrainian corn crop is a very important story. Because it's likely at this stage we can say it's going to be a record high crop above previous records, but with limited weather cooperation, it could go substantially higher from by 4, 3, 5 million tons, implying that those additional 5 million tons, for example, could go to China. And, you know, we don't if you're a farmer in the U.S. Corn Belt, you don't want to see those cancellations because of that Ukraine crop. And that could definitely happen this year. And I think that's a number one story to follow during the next several months.
All right. Andre, I appreciate the time so much. Thank you for your insight. And it's always fascinating to learn about other parts of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
My thanks to Andre Sisov in our discussion today about Russia and Ukraine and the Black Sea. If you have any feedback, hit me up, markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Thanks for the time. We'll see you next time.